Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
What if the golf ball you're playing isn't the number one ball for you? Meet the all-new TP5 and TP5X from TaylorMade. Whether you prefer the softest five-layer tour ball in the TP5 or the fastest, that's now a half a club longer in TP5X, you'll be playing a golf ball that performs like it was built just for you. Available in white, yellow, and picks, you can personalize it with my symbol. No matter which you choose, every TP5, TP5X is designed to help your game. Head to TaylorMadeGolf.com today to find the number one ball for you.
I had a very good weekend this past weekend. I got another good weekend coming up with some more of my pals, so no complaints here.
Yeah, you're being like a little, kind of like a little bridesmaid traveling around right now, aren't you?
I know. I'm just trying to keep all my pals happy. But last weekend was great. It was with all my football buddies playing golf. As we know, we enjoy golf on this podcast. And then this weekend, I got the bachelor party in Chicago. Never been to Chicago in the summer. I've been to Chicago, but always in the winter when it's miserable. So I'm looking forward to checking it out in the summer.
Yeah, I've been up there a few times. It was nice. Had a good time last year whenever Big Cat and a bunch of us went to the NLCS. That was pretty fucking dope.
Yeah, so how's Wrigley? I mean, obviously Wrigley's awesome and it's a lot of fun. But from your perspective, how was it? I've never been.
You know, I wish I was there before they made large-scale renovations, because whenever you're going to Wrigley for the first time, you feel like it should be majestic, that it should have this old look. But I think they've renovated it so much, it doesn't even really look like an old ballpark anymore.
It doesn't have that same feel of maybe like a Fenway?
No, and you have, I mean, the seats are all brightly colored because they're basically brand new. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have that old time feel. I mean, it's still pretty cool because you still are aware that it's Wrigley. I mean, you have the ivy on the wall, like, you know, it's Wrigley, but it didn't feel like I thought it would growing up walking in, where you're just like, oh damn.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when I think of Wrigley, I think of like rookie of the year, you know, with the ivy and the old time baseball feel, you know,
did you ever play at the Big House in Michigan?
No. We're playing there in a couple years, but I personally have never played there.
So when the first time you walk out the Big House, it feels like you expect it to feel. And I'm sure Notre Dame is the same way.
Yeah, no, we played at Notre Dame, and that's definitely has that feel. I remember we went in after warm-ups and then came out, and the stadium was full, and you're like, okay, this is one of the cathedrals of college football.
And it's a dope experience. Like when you walk in and you just see how far, like at Michigan, how far Michigan goes down to the ground. Because you're looking at it from the outside and you're thinking, how does 110,000 people fit in here?
Right.
Then you walk in and you're like, oh, fuck, that's how.
Yeah, absolutely.
This place is ridiculous.
Absolutely. I think the first time I saw 100,000 people in a stadium, I was down when I was down at Fort Hood and I went to UT. And it's just one of those cool things, I think. I'm a sucker for like the stadiums across the country, the more well-known ones. And I went to Neyland Stadium for a Tennessee game last year. And the same type of thing. You just walk in, you're like, wow, this is impressive to see this many people, this fired up for a game. So I'm a junkie about that sort of thing. So the fact that I'm getting a chance to experience Wrigley this weekend is something I'm really looking forward to.
Playing any golf while you're there?
No. None of the guys I'm going with are really into golf enough to where they would make it part of the weekend. They're more into the alcohol and the food. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be more one of those weekends. But we will be out on Lake Michigan on Saturday. I'm looking forward to that as well. I've heard there's a place called the Playpen, apparently, I'm told. Big Cat told me it's quite the scene on a summer Saturday. So I can't express my excitement enough. I think this is going to be a really good trip.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you get to see the old traditional stuff, it's always great. Mm-hmm. That being said, this week, there's a golfer who kind of lights the golfing world on fire. Like, when I talk to Riggs and I talk to Trent about this dude, they don't like him. Mm-hmm. Bryson DeChambeau. Like, they don't like him because he brags about being... I don't know if he's... Does he brag about being a physicist?
I think that just the way he presents himself, he comes off as, you know, I'm smarter than you. The way you would think, like, you know, we obviously know Riggsy well. He doesn't come off as your stereotypical Harvard guy, like, oh, I went to Harvard, so I'm smarter than you. That's the impression you get from DeChambeau. It's because he's doing something different with his club lengths, and he's approaching golf from a real scientific standpoint, that it almost comes off with this air of, maybe arrogance, and it's just it's not what you would expect from a young golfer.
Which is surprising that people get upset about that, because if there's any sport that's like arrogance and
right,
it's golf, you know.
Yeah.
Like that's it, because a lot of the dudes who play have a lot of money, and especially tour guys, they grew up wealthy, because you're not by and large, you're not going to get to that stage of golfing unless you grew up in a pretty wealthy family with coaches and shit like that. You're just not.
More often than not, yes. The kids that become professional golfers grew up at country clubs.
So Bryson, he, for those that are listening who don't really follow golf, he has one length clubs that he does. Every single club is the same length of a 7-iron. Normally, if you're going down from driver all the way down to your wedges, the shorter that you hit the club, typically the shorter that the club is going to be. So the driver is the longest, then the 3-wood, then the 3-wood hybrid, then the 3-iron, and so on and so forth. Well, he uses clubs that are all the same length. And he's not the first person to ever do it. It was done in the 80s. I think I even read that, what's the old Bob something?
Ben Hogan?
Yeah, Ben Hogan was a one-length golf dude.
Okay.
So Bryson.
Or are you thinking of Bobby Jones?
Bobby Jones. There we go. Yeah, Bob. I knew Bob. I knew there was a Bob something. So
both dead.
Bryson was,
by the way, chaps, both of those guys are dead.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, they're dead. So Bryson was the first dude to bring it back and play on the tour with same length clubs for a long time. It got me thinking that to do that kind of shit, you either have to be a physicist, like Bryson is, or a lance corporal.
Yeah.
Because you will, because the thought process behind it really is so simple. Like he was saying that if you only have to learn one swing, one plane, then you're going to be more consistent because you only have to swing on one single plane. That is shit that a lance corporal would think of. You are going to do it the easiest way possible, the most brain dead way possible, but he's doing it as a physicist. And I think a lot of times that was one of my greatest skills as a young Marine, was figuring out something difficult in the easiest way just because I was lazy. And this, like, Bryson seems like it could be born from being lazy too. You're like, I'm not going to learn fucking 11 different swings. I'm just going to learn one.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make. It's not about trying to be more efficient. It's about, I'm lazy. I'd rather just learn one club than 14 clubs. So I guess I get it.
And I'm like fascinated by the fact that it's so simple, yet everybody's treating him like he's doing it because it's a physicist thing, when really it should be common sense.
I guess so. No, that makes sense. You know, it certainly does. But I think it's the way he presents it. It doesn't come off that way. It presents it like I'm going to be different than the rest of the game.
When he starts having all the charts and shit, and like starts talking about like in the crazy science way, just be like, hey, I'm doing it smarter, not harder.
Exactly. That was just going to say. That is a common theme across all branches of the military. It is, we work smarter, not harder. And that could be interpreted as we're lazy or we want to be more efficient. Depends on who you are and how you want to approach it.
Yeah, there are just certain things that you should do that are the simple way, like using Simple Safe to protect your home whenever you're going out and you have to go out of town like Cons is this weekend. He'll have Simple Safe locked into his house, and there's a million things that you can do every day to keep your family safe, but this is one of the easiest ones. The Simple Safe home security system is another fantastic way to keep your family safe, your belongings safe, because no matter where you're at, crime is a problem. You want to make sure that you have everything secured. Each Simply Safe system is a security arsenal expertly engineered to protect your home. You can get yourself this system set up in under an hour. There's no drilling or hardwiring required. It's all Wi-Fi based. It's simple, fast wireless connection to authorities and police dispatches. 24/7 alarm system for just $14.99 a month. That's like a little bit more than your Netflix bill. No hidden fees, no annoying gotchas. That's it. No long-term contracts either. Simply Safe will never lock you in like other alarm companies do. You get 60-day risk-free trial to try it out in your home to see if you like it. I can't recommend it enough. SimplySafe.com/barstool to order today. If you order today, you'll get 10% off plus a free keychain remote, which is money. Because all the time I always forget, and then I'm getting in my car and I will hit the little beep beep and it's locked, just like your car would if you're walking in somewhere. So go to SimplySafe.com/barstool Barstool. 10 years as a dog trainer in the Marine Corps. I was the chief military working dog instructor at Lackland Air Force Base before I got out, went to college, and joined Barstool. So that's the background.
So recently on my trip to San Diego or home from San Diego, I was noticing that while we were boarding the plane, there were two different people who were carrying smaller dogs. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I'd imagine that how we travel with dogs in the military is different than how we travel with dogs commercially. But I guess my question is that the most efficient way to travel with a dog, to, I guess, buy them a seat and have them sit in the seat next to you? Or is it better to crate them and have them fly underneath? I don't know much or anything, actually, at all about what it's like for them to fly underneath or if that's the safe way to do it or what. So I'm asking you, what's the best way to fly with a dog?
It really depends on the demeanor of the dog. If you're going to have a hyper dog, I would throw the little asses underneath because they are just going to be in their kennel. And typically, every dog that I've ever been around in a plane, because, you know, military planes aren't pressurized the same way that civilian planes are. Like whenever you're flying in a C-130 or a C-17 or something like that, it's so much colder in there because they just don't have the same luxury level.
Right.
All these dogs, and we flew to Iraq with probably 50 dogs stacked inside of a plane, all of them, without fail, pass out because of the difference in pressure. So whenever you're flying a dog, typically they might bark for the first 5 or 10 minutes, and then they're going to go to sleep just because of the pressure difference. It's really relaxing for the dogs to be under there, as opposed to in the cabin when the flight attendants are going by constantly. You have the dog might fucking get gas, so everybody around you hates you. Like, I was flying one time, man. This little fucking dog named Winston. It was like 2 years
freaking ago. Freaking Winston.
I still fucking remember Winston, this little blonde-haired bitch dog. They must have gave this dog straight-up salmon beef jerky for like a week and a half. Because this motherfucker smelled like salmon and kale in between every single seat. Was farting where you're like, no, that time the dog shit. There is no way the dog didn't shit this time.
Yeah.
So everybody hates you when you have the dog on. Well, unless it's like when I would fly somewhere with my working dog, sometimes I would keep him out because he was really well behaved and people kind of loved him.
Sure.
But unless you have a dog that's insanely well trained, shove their little asses underneath.
So I would never have known that it's actually even more comfortable for them to be crated and underneath where there's no pressure.
It's substantially cheaper too. Like you.
Oh, really? Never,
yeah. Like if you do get a seat, you have to pay for the regular seat, so you're paying $300-$400.
Sure.
Whenever they go under, they're just considered excess baggage or like a checked item. So it's $70 or whatever to check their little asses.
So yeah, that makes a lot more sense to me. Not to mention, like you said, like, you know, there's people moving about, they get distracted, and the next thing you know, if your dog is that's probably worse than a baby crying, if your dog just starts barking in the middle of a plane cabin.
Yeah, because people understand you can't just throw your little infant underneath the cabin of the plane. Like, you can't.
Although
do that.
I'm sure some parents would like to it sometimes.
Oh, dude, every parent would. If they had like a under the plane baby daycare, no chance that every parent doesn't do that, man. You do run into some problems where, and I think it happened recently to a rapper where his dog in, I think it was Schoolboy Q, went somewhere and his dog ended up in the same city, a different city. That happened to me whenever I came back from Iraq. My dog went to a different place in Japan. So you do run that risk.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about that. That kind of stinks. But so, like, do the dogs...
That was very dismissive, kind of stinks. It really fucking sucks.
I just remember you telling that story the first time.
After for like 35 hours, dude.
No, I remember you telling the story. You told it on the show, and it was really, really a horrific situation. It really stunk for your dog. So I apologize if it appeared as though I was dismissive. But so do the dogs react the same way that we do in terms of like ear pressure and stuff? You know how like our ears will pop? Will that like bother
them?
Not
really, because they pant so much. I think that it automatically gets rid of it. Like they breathe in and out of their mouth so much that they're doing it because they will pant their little asses off and they always come out looking mad. It doesn't matter if it's like a 2-hour flight. It looks like they just walked out of a homeless shelter.
Okay. So is it scary for them? Do they worry?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I would think it's a little bit scary. It's going to be scary either way because they don't know what's going on with their ear, like the sudden change. I mean, dogs feel so much through their pads whenever they're sitting. So they can feel vibrations much more than humans can. That's one reason why they know when the weather's going to change, because they can feel it in the ground on their hands. So whenever you would walk in through ships and stuff like that, whenever I would take my dog to go like do a drug search or a bomb search on a big ship that was leaving for a Mew, you could tell the dogs that it was their first time on a ship because they're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Why is the ground moving like that?
Right.
Or whenever you're in Japan, which has a lot of earthquakes, you could tell that they were coming before the humans knew because the dogs would like crouch down because they feel it in their pads.
Okay. Okay. So you heard it here first. The best way to travel with a dog is put your dog underneath with the rest of the cargo. And I have one other question that I thought of as you were saying it. When you're talking about you had your working dog on the plane, obviously people see a dog, I think most people's inclination is to want to pet that dog. And oftentimes you see on service dogs or working dogs with police or military, anybody, they have, you know, a little sign on them that says, please do not pet, I'm a working dog. What is the thought behind that? And also, is it ever acceptable if I were to ask permission if I could pet your dog? Is it okay then?
I mean, you could always ask. They're just always going to say no. I mean, if you catch somebody that's off duty, I'm sure they'll let you. But when you're on duty, it's just not going to happen. One, because like my dogs are trained to attack with or without command. That's one thing that we would always tell people when we were going up to do an apprehension. We'd be like, listen, this is a military worker dog that I'm accompanied by. He's trained to attack with or without command. So the dog is trained that if somebody comes at me or makes a lunging motion toward me to immediately attack without me even telling him to. Mm-hmm. So if you're coming up, especially if you've been drinking and you're like, hey, what's up, chaps, blah, 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 blah. Like, good to see you. Can I pet your dog? And you come up with your hand up.
Like a lunge. Okay.
Yeah. The that's dog, how we train yeah, the them like what to look for.
Interesting. So
it's better not to do that. So and one, you want the dog focused on what he's doing, not on looking for pets. Because you want, as a working dog handler, you want all praise, all food, everything coming from you to the dog. So then they look to you for every single thing. They look for affection. They look for food. They look for water. All the good things in their life come from you. So that's why they work for you.
Interesting. Interesting. So that's also probably why my pal down in Austin one time, when he made an attempt to pet a horse, a police horse, the female police officer grabbed him by the wrist violently and said, do not touch my horse. I'd imagine that's the same thinking there.
Yeah, man, you just don't – you spend so much time training and they got to do – and you don't want to get spooked. I mean,
spooking
a big-ass horse.
Right. So, you know, it's not that dog handlers or any type of animal handler is a bad person or doesn't want you to enjoy their dog. It's just for your own safety. So I think that's important to note.
Very much so. And a lot of that stuff is just being courteous and recognizing your surroundings and what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to have our next guest come on. She works for Task and Purpose. She's a reporter from there. She has some great articles. The last couple times I've been to Task and Purpose, which if you don't read Task and Purpose, you should.
Mm-hmm,
it's a great source of military knowledge that they do a lot of great military reporting. I get a lot of my stuff from there. We're going to have their editor-in-chief on in a few weeks whenever I'm up in New York. He's great, too. But we're having Sarah on now. Here comes Sarah. Well, now on Zero Block 30, I'd like to welcome from Task and Purpose, Sarah Sicard. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I've been reading a lot of your articles, actually. Whenever they pop up on Task and Purpose, I'm almost getting your bylines down where I kind of know that it's a Sarah article because they're super interesting. You're doing really, really good work there. But there was one article in particular because where I work at Barstool, I try to make people laugh all day. And I came across a certain article where it talks about a Navy officer who, when he was in Afghanistan, right, he made the commitment to try to honor people who lost their lives during service. Is that the background of the story?
Yeah, I think it was Iraq, actually. I'm not entirely certain when he served there, but he says that when he was there, he made a promise to God that he would honor his fellow service members and veterans with a tribute every day. And so when he made it home to his town in Glen Rock in Pennsylvania, that's, you know, TAPS is sort of how he decided to go about it.
And he's not just some like lower enlisted guy. This is a Navy O4 who's pretty decorated. I'm looking at his picture right now. He's a pretty decorated guy. So he's served for a long time. To get to an O4 in the Navy, you're going to be around for a bit. And he was. And you would think that that kind of story would be endearing, that because usually, especially in the heartland of America, somewhere like Pennsylvania, people are really pro-America and even pro, like, troops and everything like that. So to hear that his neighbors got upset about it was kind of surprising. It was a twist in the article. Can you kind of tell us why they were getting upset?
Originally he was broadcasting the song nightly at, I believe, 7:58, and it's a 57-second song, and he was playing it on a boombox on his front porch, and no one really minded that. In fact, a number of his neighbors thought it was very, like, adorable and endearing. But then, I guess, shortly thereafter, he installed a 30-foot pole and began broadcasting the song on speakers from a fairly high decibel every night.
And I know Cons, no, my co-host Cons, he knows for sure that we used to do that on military bases, but it was right at sunset where you play taps. And even on military bases, if we're being honest, everybody fucking hates it. Like,
well, no, we don't play taps. We play retreat.
Retreat.
When we take the flag down, which that's right. Something. I don't even think it's 57 seconds, but it's something that you just kind of understand and you're used to, and it's never to the point where it's so loud that it's obnoxious. It's just something that you hear, and you know, if you're in your car, you stop, you get out, you salute the flag, and it's just part of your routine.
Yeah, but that is. In a perfect world, in real world, on a military base, you know, especially junior level troops, once they hear that the initial it's about to start, everybody is trying to like fly inside so they don't have to stand out there. And
Billion percent. Yes, absolutely.
So even on military bases, this kind of shit wouldn't fly. And taps is depressing.
Yeah.
It's really, really depressing. And it affects people in different ways. And one of his neighbors was... the wife of a fallen service member. Can you give us a little background information on that, Sarah?
One of his neighbors, I guess across the way, she is a widow. Her husband was in the Army, and he died from an undisclosed illness in 2001. And she actually moved to this town, Glen Rock, to sort of start a new life because the house that she had lived in Baltimore before her husband died was filled with too many memories. And so she said when the tap started playing, you know, every night, it was basically a constant reminder of his funeral. She's like, every night, you know, around 8 p.m., I start to hear it. And I remember when they were folding up, you know, his flag at his funeral to give to me. And she basically was so upset to have to relive that every day.
And she even went to the lieutenant commander and told him that, right?
She said that she had him in her home and, you know, tried to share her story with him and, you know, sort of said that it wasn't, you know, it's not necessarily that he does it every day. It's that, you know, she can hear it from every part of her house every day. And, you know, she wishes that she could escape it.
I'm sure. And the fact that this guy was a lieutenant commander and is not taking that into consideration,
right,
blows my mind.
Right, because, I mean, you often hear the term officer and a gentleman. As an officer, he should hear her plea, basically. And, I can appreciate the promise he made to God and wanting to honor these men. But when someone has come to you and said, what you're doing every day is detrimental to my mental health and is really hurting me, he... From what I could read in the article, he basically just dismissed it and said, yeah, I'll pray on that. And basically, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, and I don't really care what you have to say. That was very unbecoming, if you ask me.
So, Sarah, do you think he's just doing it now out of just being stubborn and not wanting to admit that he was wrong? Or why do you think he's doing it now?
I mean, in truth, I have no idea. I reached out to him to sort of get a comment about, you know, why he would continue to do something like this while his, you know, several of his neighbors have complained that it's, you know, affecting their mental or physical well-being. As it turns out, one of his neighbors has Parkinson's disease and hearing that loud music affects him physically. But he, you know, he said that his promise to, he's told other people, other reporters, that his promise to God, you know, sort of trumps that, and the fact that he has sort of a majority of support from the town, from his neighbors, who've all come forward and said that they like hearing taps every night, and so that's sort of where he's gone with that. But he actually refused to speak with me. He deferred me instead to the ACLU about his case citing the First Amendment.
Right, and that's where I get a little fuzzy, because if you really believed in what you were saying, why would you pass it off to somebody else, right? Like, why would you feel the need to have someone else be your microphone instead of blasting your message that you believe so wholeheartedly in, that you're willing to go up against so many folks that are against you? So I had a little trouble swallowing that piece of it.
Right, of course. I have no idea really where the ruling is going to come down on that. I know that his town actually offered a concession, being that, you know, he can play every Sunday at 7:58, and that he can play it on all flag-hanging holidays, which seemed to me like a very sort of reasonable request.
1,000,000%, that was reasonable. When I read that, I was like, oh, you know, that's actually, I would think, even a little more appropriate, because I think by playing it every day, it almost loses some of the meaning. And, I can speak for myself. When I hear Taps, a lot of times that stirs up a lot of emotion for me. So I'm on the side of his neighbors to where I wouldn't want to hear that every day, because it would be depressing. So I think the town is doing a good job of giving him that compromise and doing their best. But the fact that he's still just hanging tough and being stubborn, and it's almost, it seems like, Chaps, like you said, it's like he's doing it out of spite at this point.
Yeah, no doubt.
Right.
Another point of, like, compromise was surprising to me that the VA, who is known for possibly, I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't say for sure, but I think that a lot of people are under the impression that the VA overprescribes opiate type medication. Would you agree with that, Cons?
I would, because I the first time I remember speaking to a medical professional about my PTSD, and they were real quick to offer me prescriptions to a myriad of different drugs after only like one or two times meeting with them, and that was surprising to me.
And Sarah recently wrote an article about doctors are getting closer and closer, based on the Senate Appropriations Committee passing a vote on July 13th, 24-7, which is pretty shocking that it was that nonpartisan of a vote, that they would give VA doctors the ability to prescribe marijuana. Can you give us a little more background on your story there, Sarah?
Right. So on July 13th, Senate Appropriations passed an amendment that would essentially give doctors through VHA hospitals the ability to sort of recommend, not prescribe, but recommend medical marijuana in states where there are, legal medicinal uses available. And so it's not necessarily that VA is totally on board with prescribing medicinal marijuana, but they've taken away, this amendment essentially takes away the funding that investigates and prevents doctors from making recommendations for medical marijuana.
Okay, so they wouldn't be able to, like, you go pick it up from the pharmacy. They would say, could they, because I know in a lot of states that have medical marijuana, the doctor has to basically prescribe it and give you a prescription. Would they be able to do that, or just tell the veteran that they should go seek out a doctor who would make that recommendation?
The latter, yeah. You'd essentially be able to go to any one of those state-run or state-approved medical marijuana facilities and sort of get your prescription there, which is a big step for VA, where, before it was, they can't even make the recommendation because you could lose your VA benefits if you were caught with marijuana in your system.
Hmm. Yeah, like I know whenever I first went, my doctor, he told me, he was like, if we were able to give recommendations on marijuana, that's what I would do, but we're not allowed to. So, like, they would say things that would, like, really skirt around the issue. And marijuana, like, the new VA secretary, he's being more open about it than in the past. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, he's actually, he's a doctor himself, and I think he hasn't come, out and just said that he supports the use of marijuana, but he said that he does support any sort of study that, researches or puts more research into, better treatment options for veterans for medical conditions, PTSD, et cetera.
And that's so refreshing to hear because, you know, it's almost like the VA has been so insane for a long time. You know, you often hear what's insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. If we've been treating PTSD and some of these other illnesses and injuries the same way over and over and we're not getting any better, why not explore these new methods that in some studies have shown have had success? So I think, you know, I'd say kudos to the VA for being willing to explore these experimental usage of marijuana. I think it's a great thing, and I applaud them for trying to go outside the box. Because, you know, if they don't, we can't expect anything to get any better. It's like, you know, way back when a common fever could kill someone, but eventually, you know, medicine continued to do research and found new ways to where now you get a fever, you know, you take some aspirin, whatever, the fever goes away. Well, I think that's where we are with, you know, PTSD in particular right now, where, you know, we can't keep doing the same thing. We got to figure out new ways to combat it. And I think that's why this is so great.
Sarah, do you think that they're going to use the veterans as like a social experiment with marijuana? Because that's, I mean, we've done that with like gay marriage and things like that as well. Do you think that that's the step that we're looking at with these new developments?
I don't know necessarily if that's going to be the case. I mean, whether or not these state-run medicinal marijuana sort of programs are, you know, sort of keeping track of, you know, the impact that they're having, that would probably be a better question. But that's obviously not veteran-specific. I think that it would certainly be interesting for the VA to participate in some kind of experiment or something along those lines to really, you know, see if this is something that, you know, helps veterans with their PTSD or TBI. But at this point, I don't know if there's any, you know, movement on that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Sarah. We really appreciate it. And check out her work at Task and Purpose. She's doing great things over there. Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
All right. Big shout out to Sarah for joining us. Task and Purpose, great, great place, great website. They do great shit. And it's usually pretty, if you hate your news cycles to be either left or right, Task and Purpose does a great job of just being like, hey, here's the fucking information. Here's right. How it affects vets, and we don't really give a shit about anything else.
Right. And it's an easy read, too. I've never found it to be overly complicated or overly military. So it's always a great read. And one other thing I just want to reiterate about the marijuana use, I think it's important to echo what General Hammond said last month when we spoke. He's all for the usage of marijuana for the PTSD treatment, and I agree with that. But remember, he said he doesn't want it to become a crutch. He wants to get veterans the help they need so they can deal with PTSD on their own, and they don't need pills. They don't need marijuana. And if they are going to use marijuana, it's because it's legal in their state, and they want to recreationally. So I think that's where I stand. But again, I just want to say I think it's great that we're seeing a lot of movement from the VA, right? We're seeing them trying to fix things, which is encouraging.
Well, I think that trend has been going on for a while. Mm-hmm. I think that it was just really common for vets to shit on the VA.
Yep.
When in reality, the VA does some pretty good stuff, and it's the veterans who, one, it's educating before they get off of active duty that's a problem, and two, that they don't take the steps to get it, and then they just complain that they're not getting it, they're not getting the services that they're due when they're not making the steps to go get them.
Yes, that is true, because the VA still, you know, it's not perfect, and they are doing their best, I think, but a lot of times, too, there are necessary steps to take, and it's not instant gratification sometimes where you'd like to be getting help. But at the same time, yes, I do think some veterans would just prefer to just shit on the VA as opposed to going through the necessary steps, and I don't think that's fair to the VA. And then also the veterans not getting help.
Yeah, and it was 6 years ago is when I started my process with the VA, and it took, the average time to get a claim through was 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's 4 months. When President Obama left office, it was 4 months. That's a huge improvement.
Yeah.
In a few years for a bureaucracy as big as the VA.
Yeah.
What you might have trouble getting some VA services with, if you're the dude who's going to get discharged with dereliction of duty, probably end up with a bad conduct discharge because the dude was found hiding in a ship's engine room after being there for 6 days.
That's here. There had to have been other people involved because you got to get food somehow, unless he was sneaking food or maybe he brought a ton of food in there. But, you know, it's like maybe he thought that, like, when you know, when you're, like, you're a kid and you get in trouble, so maybe you run away. So when you eventually come back, everyone's just so thrilled to see you that they'll forget about the bad thing you did. So maybe, I don't know, maybe he did something bad and he thought he was running away and they were so happy he wasn't drowning, missing at sea, that they were going to forget about that. But yeah, the Navy and the military in general takes dereliction of duty quite seriously.
Yeah, because they spent 50 hours searching mm-hmm. for him in an area that covered 5,500 square miles.
That's a large ass area.
And the search was suspended 3 days later, but the crew continued to look for him. Like, what level of don't give a fuck do you have to reach where you hear everybody looking for you over the loudspeakers, constantly coming through, shouting your name, and you're just like,
I'm
nah.
good. I'm just going to stick it out. Because then that's the thing, too. What's your end game? Eventually, you have to get off that ship. If you don't want to die, you're going to have to get off that ship at some point. What's your end
game? I don't know what your plan is. I mean, you have to be going through something mentally to be that naive to think that this is going to turn out okay.
Yeah.
Because
believe me, I'll tell you what, man. There were times in the military where I was like, you know what? I wish I could just go away and not be here right now. I was thinking back on times. There was a time we were out in the field in Texas, no less, and I was in the S3 shop doing operations, and it snowed, so we weren't firing our artillery, and I was basically just sitting in a tent all day because there wasn't anything for me to track and ensure that we were doing the right thing. And I was bored. I was like, I wish I could be anywhere else right now and just walk away. But I didn't obviously have that luxury. But were there ever times in the Marines where you were just like, you know what? I just need to get away.
Yeah, and luckily for me, I was a dog handler, so I had that ability. I mean, there's only so many times that you can go clean the shit out of 50 dogs' kennels, like where you just like, I'm done, dude. Like, yeah. I am fucking done. Because you have to start your day with a certain military appearance. Like, every single day, you have to look good in uniform. Mm-hmm. After years of cleaning shit, the very first thing that you do in the morning, you start smelling shit at 5:30 in the morning every day for years. It affects your mind, dude.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where you just
imagine.
Like, son of a bitch. Your uniform looks good, and then you walk in, and we had some of these dogs are called painters, like where they would like paint Picasso-style pictures with their shit.
A Jackson Pollock, almost.
Just little maligators that jump up and would touch the ceiling with their shit-covered paws and rub it all over their skin and rub it all over their fur, and then you got to get it out. And if you spray them, they get angry, and they're attack dogs, so you got to go in there and, like, calm them down. It's a stupid way to start. So occasionally it would bother you so much, your boots are covered in shit, your trousers are covered in shit, where you just got to take a walk. And luckily for me, my young years, I was in a place called Okinawa. And down the flight line and to the left was a little slice of heaven where we had like a little swimming hole where me and Saika, it would just be us in the afternoon. I would take him. His little dumbass would jump into the water. My dumbass would jump in the water. And it was basically like we were Brooke Shields and Return to the Blue Lagoon. Just hanging out. Just making sure we didn't step on anything sharp to get in trouble. And we would just swim about, dude. It was great.
That's
being a dog
awesome.
In there was the shit.
That's awesome. And that's a great point that you made, though, too. Like, when the first thing you do every day is make sure your uniform is looking right and looking tight, and then it gets dirty, that is such a crippling feeling. Like, last weekend, when I was out in San Diego, we were imbibing a little bit, and I spilled a nice full-body red on my shirt that I had only worn two times before. And it, like, crippled me. I spilled red wine on my shirt. And I was just, like, ruined for the rest of the night. I was just, my mood was just shot. And obviously, like, there's nothing you can do about it. So you would think I would just go on with my night having fun. But in the military, it's like you can't walk around the rest of the day.
Yeah,
with shit
and
if you live
a distance away, you have to go home, dude.
Yeah.
Like, you have to go, especially if you're a young guy. If you're a young guy or if you're an officer, you're always supposed to look good. Me as a dog handler, one of my main bosses would come out. And I had shit on my uniform. it's part of the uniform, like midday, like you're just going to be dirty. And young Marines are dirty fucks anyway. So you're going to be dirty whenever you're doing your job. You as an officer, if you spill something, you got to go home because the guys can't see you that way.
No, you got to be the beacon of leadership, the beacon of example. So
kind of like Winters when Winter was shaving, even though he was breaking the ice to say.
Exactly. Exactly. Speaking of Winters, how you been enjoying that book?
I feel like it's, you know, go back to my Sunday school teacher days, which I talked about on the Podfathers too. It almost feels like one of those little devotionals that you can read, you know, like chicken soup for the soul type thing.
Yeah.
You read these little nuggets of wisdom that he has. He talked about one point, I saw one interview where he talked about how do you get anything, get good at anything. And he said, you get good at anything by training like a boxer. He's like, if you look at anything in your life and you approach it like you're a boxer, that you will become good at it. And he went on to explain, he's like, if you're trying to become a boxer, you don't just watch boxing on TV. You go to the gym. You go to the gym every day. You box. You throw lefts. You throw rights. You throw hooks. You throw jabs. You throw everything. You move around with your feet. You're constantly engaged with it every single way. He said, when you're a leader, that's what you do. You are constantly engaged with your troops. You're engaged with your hires. You're engaged with books on leadership. You're engaged watching other leaders. You're engaged in every single aspect of your life. Approach anything in life like you were a boxer. Approach that task like you're a boxer, and you'll do great at it. And I was like, fuck, man. Like, I need to be a boxer in many areas of my life right now.
No, that's a – yeah, that's the thing. It's not just – it's anything you can approach with that that approach, and it's just unbelievable how many times in the book you're like, wow, this guy is just so freaking smart. But he even said it himself. What, you know, Band of Brothers, the series, they gloss over in the consideration of time, but those guys were in England training for 9 months before D-Day, and he said he went home to the family that he lived with. And every day he was studying his manuals. Every day he was studying tactics. He was studying to make sure that he was the best leader he could be. And if you think about that, when you see some of the things he did in combat, you're like, oh, well, that's why he was able to act like that, because he was so well prepared. It's just, I can't recommend the book enough. It's so impressive.
That's very, very good. Any favorite alibis this week?
I had one from Band of Brothers that in episode 10, when that private was drunk and he shot the Easy Company member in the head, and they obviously were able to save him. They found that brain surgeon in the middle of the night. But something that was interesting to me that would, I don't think, fly in the military now, or it would probably happen in a different way, but they found that soldier and they really just beat him to a bloody pulp. And I was just curious what your thoughts were on that.
I like it.
Yeah.
I think that whenever you're in that position, especially in that period of time, what are you going to do? Are you going to like haul him off to the brig or something like that? Like, when you're at that point, you deserve a beating, man. Like, and there's not very many aspects that I would say that in. You drunkenly shoot one of your fellow soldiers, you almost kill him, you deserve a beating. So I'm good with it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's a miracle that he wasn't killed, that he shot his brain. They were able to find a brain surgeon in the middle of the night and bring him to the hospital, and that German doctor was able to save him. That was impressive. And then, oh, one other thing, and it was reminded because I was I'm rereading Winters' book now, and in the beginning, and they were talking about Captain Sobel and how inept he was at reading a map. And I could tell you, luckily I was very good at map reading, and I have a pretty good sense of direction, so that was never really an issue for me. But there were times where you're like, I think I'm going the right way, but you have to like double check a bunch of times. I just wanted to say, and you can probably relate, but there is nothing that is more uncomfortable of a feeling as a leader than everyone looking at you and you not being sure where you're going. So I can imagine for Sobel, like, one, he doesn't even know what he's looking at, because you think about it, like a map, especially a military map, it's something on a paper and it represents what you're looking at, but then you look up and you see the 3D world, and It can be confusing. No, it's not easy.
I think there was parts in the Civil War where we tried to make it seem like it was easy. It's a skill that takes years to get good at.
Right.
To be able to identify little tiny terrain features on a map that look nothing like that. I mean, elevation doesn't look like squigglies. Like, you know, it just doesn't.
No.
So whenever he's going through that, but the difference is where Sobel made his mistake is because he was such a cock the entire time.
Yep.
If you are a leader that is worth his salt and you turn around to your leadership, especially your older enlisted guys, like your advisors, and you're like, hey, dudes, I need help real quick. Like, let's figure this out together. Right. That's what you should be doing. Not saying I know all the answers all the time. Because when you have that type of attitude and you don't know, if you're going to be cocky, you better be fucking good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good skill to learn no matter where you're at in life. Like, Dave Portnoy isn't Dave Portnoy if he wasn't actually one of the best on the internet.
Like, exactly.
He couldn't act the way that he does if he was shitty at it. Like, that just doesn't work out.
No.
Can't do it.
No.
You cannot do it.
But one thing I will say, Major Winters does in his book, I mean, he speaks very candidly about Sobel, but he doesn't do it in a way that I felt like he was trying to bring him down. He was just being frank. Like, I didn't think he was a very good field tactician. I didn't think he was a good leader, and I didn't agree with the way he decided to lead men, and that was just that. But it is very apparent that Sobel was not cut out for combat, so it worked out for the men at Easy Company that he didn't lead them.
And there's plenty of dudes that I'm sure you know, guys that were like that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And women. Like, there's some that were great in combat. I used to do a thing all the time. I had a Marine named Taylor, and it's such a common name that it won't even matter. Taylor was a fucking idiot, dude.
Like, yeah.
He was terrible at any task that you asked him to do in a garrison environment in a non-combat deployed area. Terrible. Mm-hmm. Like, Taylor, go pick up cigarettes from the parking lot. Still cigarettes fucking all over the parking lot when he's done. Taylor, go fucking buff the floors. Like, not using Marine terminology there where everybody can understand me, almost fucked my head up. So go buff the decks. Shitty job. Looked terrible.
Yeah.
He was a pack mule, though. I would take him to combat any day of the week because he was like 5'9", like 180 pounds of just muscle. Like, he looked like an Iowa wrestler, like where he was just a big kid. You could just pack him full of stuff like he was a fucking donkey on Winnie the Pooh and be like, take all this shit with you. I'm not carrying hardly anything because I need to have freedom of movement. He'd be like, roger that, Sergeant, got it.
Right. And that's where Sobel was good. Like, in a training environment, they did say, like, to Sobel's credit, Easy Company was in better shape than anybody else because he pounded them so hard and ensured that they were in great shape.
Which did help them because kind of muscle memory lasts. Like, in all the things that they went through for a year, if they weren't in that good of shape, they probably don't get through it.
Yes, and Major Winters said, mental strength comes from being physically strong. When things aren't going to break down your body, that allows you to be mentally strong. So when you're in like a Bastogne and life sucks, you know, it makes it, I'm not going to say easier, but it helps you cope with the situation better. If you're physically in great shape and you're not worrying about, Jesus, my legs hurt right now, or I'm tired or I'm winded, the fact that you're getting shot at allows you to focus on being shot at and how I want to react to that versus, geez, I'm tired. So he did credit Sobel in that regard. He just wasn't ready to be a combat leader.
Yep. All right, well, you will be back from Chicago next week. I will be in studio in New York next week. We got some big interviews coming down. We have a woman who wrote a book about the actual house that Bin Laden was found in. It's like the technical side of everything that happened with Osama Bin Laden that isn't really well known. She wrote an amazing book on it. I read it recently. I can't wait to talk to her about it because it was like enthralling the entire time, the way this dude was living, what people thought about Osama Bin Laden, how he actually was. The differences are pretty damn incredible. We're also going to have our first foreign soldier, an Australian combat diver, is going to come on the show and tell us what it's like to be an Australian badass. We're going to have Jared, who is the editor-in-chief of, or the senior editor of Task and Purpose. So big things coming down the pipe. Can't wait. Sound their treat.